Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Would you say you lead a vibrant, wondrous life, or is something holding you back? It takes a sort of enduring exuberance to pursue our dreams over the course of a lifetime, especially when we have to balance our loftiest aspirations with down-to-earth responsibilities of everyday existence. My guest today believes we all have the potential to lead vibrant lives and form deep connections to others if we can embrace the kind of risks that keep us from falling into personal, professional, or creative ruts. Journalist and author Greg LaVoy writes about this in his new book, Vital Signs, the Nature and Nurture of Passion. Greg, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
I love this. You characterize passion as a survival mechanism. Talk about that.
Yeah. My sense of it is that our attachment to life really depends on our interest in it. And I think that I even ran across some studies that indicated that immune function, heart function, nervous system function is related to the sense of vitality physically that people have. And so this is a survival mechanism. That's why I say that. I think that having vitality is about life force. After all, that's really what it's about. And there's a distinct connection there. And I think we need to stay engaged in life in order to really let it unfold and even have longevity.
You clearly believe that we can all have this in our lives, but it seems like there are a lot of people out there who think, well, that's fine for the chosen few who got lucky and they somehow were born with this passion. Why do people fail to believe that they can have that kind of zeal for their own lives?
Why do they fail to believe it? Because there are so many downward pulling forces that come at the individual from the minute they come into the game. I remember this book the poet Robert Bly wrote called A Little Book on the Human Shadow. And he describes this scenario where we come into the world and we have a 360-degree personality, just energy, exuberance radiating out in all directions until our parents start sending us to our rooms for radiating certain parts of it, right?
Right.
Too much exuberance. Inside voice.
Yeah.
That's right, exactly. And the same thing happens then in going to school, where in order to fit in order to have report cards that say gets along well with others, we have to slice even more of ourselves off and kind of stuff it. Same thing in the working world. There are parts of our personalities, organizational life, would probably prefer you leave out in the parking lot when you punch in. So one force after another, just these tampering and tempering forces that rob people of their sense of vitality. And then at some point you try to get it back. And this is not so easy.
But it works a little bit like Newton's laws of motion, right? A body in motion tends to stay in motion. A body at rest tends to stay at rest.
Right. Which I think works against one of the other laws, which is entropy, mm-hmm. which says that systems tend to lose energy over time unless more energy is pumped into that system. So in other words, a hot cup of coffee will eventually cool down unless you reheat it. If you stop stirring oatmeal, it will congeal. Same thing with marriages, in my opinion, by the way. But I think that we have to continually push ourselves to stay on a growing edge. Otherwise, there's a tendency to collapse. This is one of the reasons why in the book I talk so much about my mother's story, because here was a woman who was, she was in my acknowledgments page as a consummate role model in living a passionate life. But there's a postscript to that acknowledgement that bears on my personal interest in the subject, which is watching one of the first women on Wall Street, opera lover, expert skier, a model, a sculptor, a pianist, just collapse in around this exhausted core starting at around 60. And I think it was a function of some of these forces. It was retirement. It was a second divorce. Or, as she put it once, no one to do it for anymore.
Hmm.
Which is an interesting comment, because psychologists talk about what they call primary and secondary motivation. This is either doing something for its own sake, for the charge, the thrill, the challenge of it, or doing it for a payoff, right? And it turned out in my mother's case, and I wonder for how many people this is true, that when they retire, for instance, they discover that they had a kind of a radioactive core of depression in them that was just simply kept in check all those years by their busy lives. And once the busy lives slow down or stop, the depression comes to the fore. And I think, I wonder how many people have that experience.
We take it almost on faith that something like retirement will be the best thing that's ever happened to us. And yet that story's pretty common. I mean, what happened to your mother, I think, has happened to a lot of people who then, you know, often eventually find something else to do and they'll go volunteer. Some people don't find anything else. Why do we think that doing nothing is going to make us happy?
Oh, boy, I don't know that people anticipate that retirement means doing nothing. I think they perhaps expect that they're going to finally do what they really want to do. I think in a lot of cases, and of course for a lot of people, it's just, I just need to stop. I need to move to Florida and play golf, and that's as much activity as I want anymore. But I think of this story that I ran across of a couple who retired, sold their house, most of their possessions, bought an RV, took off on the road to enjoy their golden years. And according to the story, they got bored with this after apparently a couple of months. And what they did is they hooked up their traveling with what's called habitatting. So this is a subculture of RVers called caravanners who help Habitat for Humanity build homes. And so what they're doing is they're hooking it up, their golden years travel with service. And what that does is it infuses a sense of purpose into what they do. And I think that's one of the things that people get robbed of in retirement is a sense of purpose. And I don't think there's a coincidence that a lot of people, men especially, their mortality rates shoot up in the years after retirement. And I think that men are so attached, especially, or perhaps traditionally, to a sense of purpose that when they're denied that, they also just collapse.
You write about doing a Google search for the phrase, things I want to do before I die. Mm. And I was thinking about it because a lot of people have a list like that, and a lot of people are sort of making no active progress on it whatsoever.
Right. Well, a bucket list. You know, I'm impressed by this interactive public art project that was started by a New Orleans artist named Candy Chang. It was called the Before I Die Project. I don't know if you've run across this, but she put up a giant chalkboard on the side of an old abandoned building and filled it with the phrase, before I die, I want to. And then a line, and there were a couple of hundred on the board. They got filled up like that, and then she erased it. They got filled up again, and now there's something like 500 of these in 50, 70 countries around the world. And this speaks to the bucket list mindset, the part of people that's there's something they know they want to accomplish or achieve or experience, some passions that they're simply not getting to. And this dreaming life that people have, I really think needs to be brought more into the moment and the gesture, not the five-year plan, not the bucket list, not the extreme makeover, just to bring that sense of how can I bring some of this into my day-to-day-to-day, moment-by-moment life, because I really think that's where it happens. So I have these experiments. This is in terms of novelty seeking, which I think is one of the aspects of a passionate life. They call it neophilia, the urge for exploration. So I try things like getting up on the other side of the bed in the morning, sitting at a different side of the breakfast table for breakfast, going to work by a slightly different route, eating something other than my usual at the restaurant that I usually go to, or rearranging one piece of furniture in my house, just little acts of neophilia, of novelty, and it keeps things a little vibrant.
You talk about how much you can gain simply from observing really carefully the world around you. Like maybe you don't have money for a ticket across the world, but there is a lot to be found very close to home.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Do you know who Jean Houston is? The mythologist, psychologist, she's written a number of books called The Possible Human or etc. She says that people who are larger than life are not physically imposing necessarily or heroic or charismatic or living their lives on grand stages. She says that what characterizes them is that they are profoundly present to the stuff of their lives. And I think that is so key. In other words, they use their senses more than most people. they inhabit their minds and their bodies more than most people, and they have a keen urge for exploration. And that, again, is the kind of mindset that I'm after encouraging people to consider, is that this larger-than-life, which I think a lot of people aspire to, want to live a bigger life than they do, comes down to the little daily fire drills about paying exquisite attention to the life that we have right now and inhabiting our bodies and our senses more than we do.
Greg Lavoie is my guest. He's a journalist and author of the new book, Vital Signs, The Nature and Nurture of Passion. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist and author Greg Lavoie about his new book, Vital Signs, The Nature and Nurture of Passion. You can be part of our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Greg, what's the relationship between passion and risk?
Passion and risk. Well, I think to some degree the passion is in the risk. I think a lot of people think that first they need to find their passions, and then they need to start taking risks on behalf of those passions. But I think maybe just as often that you begin taking risks in your life. You make decisions. You put yourself on the line a little bit. And then your passions often begin to clarify themselves. I had a guy who I consulted with last year who said that he was convinced that he needed absolute clarity in order to begin acting on a particular passion in his life. And in the course of the conversation, I suggested that maybe the passion he seemed intent on finding, he was only going to find by taking action. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I think ultimately, this is really an essential piece. You need to ultimately take action, and perhaps ideally spontaneous action. I heard an improvisational theater person say this once, that the equation is ready, fire, aim. And I love that because we're so used to preparing before we take action. And I just think, once again, the risks that are close to home, no, you know, not the big scary ones like jumping out of airplanes and traveling the world. The ones that are much closer to home are every bit as capable of lighting our fires, taking your jokes to open mic night, or being the first to make up after a quarrel, you know, or somebody asks you, how are you doing, Chris? Say, tell them how you're really doing. You know, these kind of things that are just pushing the comfort zone just a little, I think is less likely to short people out. But ultimately, I think risk is utterly relative. It's whatever scares you.
You write candidly about years ago having struggled for a long time with a fear of the dark, and you got to this place where you said, I'm just tired of this. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah. I was living in Cincinnati, working for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and lived in a third floor walk-up Victorian. Across from the bed was an open closet with no doors. And one night I just heard this sound from in there that just immediately kicked in every monster movie I'd watched since the age of four. And I realized I have this childhood fear of the dark at 30 years old. Turns out that according to a British study, actually 40% of adults have a fear of the dark.
I think it's pretty common. People just don't talk about it.
They don't talk about it. Right. But I sat absolutely petrified, and nothing happened except the voice in my head that I eventually heard that said, I'm tired of being afraid. And I think partly what was going on for me at that point in my life was that I was trying to decide whether to follow a call to quit my job and become self-employed as a writer. So this notion of I'm tired of being afraid was not just about the dark. It was about the risk to follow my heart into freelance writing, which is not exactly a decision designed to reassure your parents or your partner or your creditors, you know. And so what I did is I used that opportunity to start working on that larger fear as well as the smaller one, the fear of the dark. So I got out of bed and I walked up to the closet. And in the dark, I knelt in front of the closet and I crawled in on my hands and knees. And I remember putting my bare wrists into every corner of the closet and then tilting my head back and baring my neck.
Like being really vulnerable.
Absolutely vulnerable. To say, all right, if there's a slasher in here, not just a slasher movie in the back of my mind going on, then I'm just going to bare myself to it, vulnerability. And you know Brené Brown's work, the Dare and Greatly work, that is a brilliant piece of work. And I think there's so much to the strength inherent in vulnerability. So that was just an opportunity to literally play it out. And I walked back out of that closet 20 or 30 minutes later and absolutely exultant that I had confronted a fear like that. And everything began to shift. So many things started to shift, including my courage for quitting my job.
And it turns out that many of us overestimate the worst thing that could happen, don't we, when we think about these risks?
Well, I certainly do. I mean, my mind goes off and I have a big imagination and I can just picture all the terrible things that can occur. But most of the fear that I find in my life is definitely in the anticipation of an event. Mm-hmm. It's so seldom in the event itself. And I think stage fright, for instance, is a perfect example. All the anxiety seems to happen in the half an hour before it. And in those couple of minutes when you're being introduced, for some reason, it just absolutely crystallizes in that moment. But as soon as the performers get up there, they find that they're in the zone. You know, so I think there's, you know, there's a way in which I think it's important to look at the kind of scripts that are going off in our heads and what they're telling us about our ability to live a vital life or to be more alive or to take risks and succeed at them, because there's a tremendous amount of crappy self-talk.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people are afraid of failure or rejection. A lot of people are just afraid of embarrassment, which is, on the one hand, we can all identify with how awful it feels to be embarrassed.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's usually not that big a deal to anyone except us.
Right, because most people are too concerned with what other people think of them,
right,
to be worried about, you know, judging you. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I remember Carl Sagan was describing in one of his books the difference between going into a kindergarten class and a high school class to talk about science. And so he says the kindergartners open for business.
Right. Whatever you say, they're into it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Avidly curious. They're just endlessly enthusiastic. They're natural born scientists and they never heard of a dumb question, right? So the notion of shame and embarrassment is so minimized at that point in the game. Then he goes to the high school class. And these kids are jaded, you know, at 15, 16, 17 years old, they're jaded. The sense of wonder relegated to kid stuff, you know, and terrified of asking dumb questions, you know. So there's that incredible, you know, typically adolescent fear of embarrassment. But I think that just follows people through their whole lives. And what a shame, you know, to be so afraid of what other people think of you, that you hold yourself back from all kinds of expressiveness. I remember my mother said one of the great benedictions of getting into her 50s and 60s and above was that she didn't care so much anymore what anybody thought. And there's a part of me that almost looks forward to that developmental station of the cross, you know, where
You're liberated.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You're liberated. I'm liberated. And I don't care so much what other people think. And I just imagine that would be emancipating.
So, Greg, there are people who have an idea of what they want to do, and maybe they know just how to do it, but they have like a job and a mortgage and responsibilities. Talk about ways to think about those things as something other than an impediment.
Mm. Right. I think one of the primary dramas, of course, for most people in following passions or following calls or whatever is the struggle between passion and security. And this is a primary dynamic. And unfortunately, this is my observation, as well as my experience, that in the contest between passion and security, security tends to win. Passion tends to get backburnered. But if it's not being expressed, in my opinion, it's being suppressed or repressed or depressed. They all mean the same thing, of course, is that to be pushed down, right? And so one question to ask is simply, what is being suppressed? What am I pushing down in order to have this safe and secure life? And I don't think that any amount of safety and security in any arena, whether it's vocational, relational, creative, whatever, is going to compensate you for whatever you, for selling your soul or giving up your passions. I think it will allow you to suffer in nicer surroundings, you know, work off your frustrations with better recreational equipment. But I just think it's important to ask, what am I giving up by focusing on security alone? And this isn't to say that I don't believe security is important for people, especially people who was talking to somebody yesterday who grew up in an alcoholic family. For that person, security is going to be of the utmost importance. So I don't mean to diminish it, but just to look at the trade-off that we're making between passion and security, I think is critical.
Do you think we want too often to have a guarantee that if we risk something, we'll win? And, we have this like real fear of failure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Clint Eastwood used to say, if you want a guarantee, buy a toaster. Because really there is no guarantee, but we want to know that all of our ducks are lined up before we leap, which frankly I think is a state of affairs that happens roughly around the same time the cows come home.
Right.
You know, this perfect sense of safety and everything's under control, and I just don't think that really life offers that quality of security.
It's kind of an illusion anyway, even if you think you have it.
I think so. I think it is an illusion, right?
So you have a whole section in the book about relationships. Mm. And, we think of passion in terms of career, and then we think of passion in terms of relationships, and they seem in some ways not related, and yet they share a lot of things in common.
Well, they do. I mean, to the degree that passion is engagement, the desire to be engaged. Obviously, this is something a lot of people in relationship want to have more of and lament, grieve the loss of in their relationships. And there's perhaps an expectation that this should sustain somehow. But, I mean, it's like everything. It's got its seasons. Passion comes and goes, and it requires diligence, requires vigilance. But this is tough because managing, again, this desire for security and passion is tough in relationship because they tend to work toward very different goals. So let's use a slightly different language. Security, instead of that, let's call it love and passion, all right? So love tends to want assurances. Passion wants abandon. Love wants to be soothed, and passion wants to be inflamed, stimulated. Love wants to go steady, mm-hmm. right? Go steady, even the language. And passion wants to be swept away, so it's tough to stay worked up over the same person that you're looking to for safety and security. It's tough to stay worked up. And so, but it's not an either-or equation, in my opinion, even though I think we've been taught that it is, that you either have passion or serenity in a relationship, but not really both. You either have freedom or commitment, but not both. You know, it's like it's either Wuthering Heights or the Remains of the Day. But it's not. It's not either or. I think it's both and we need both of them. We need both of them in relationship. And this is the high art. I've heard this described this way, that heroism or heroinism can be redefined for the modern age as the ability to tolerate paradox, to hold two contrary or seemingly contrary ideas or impulses or forces inside you at the same time, and still retain the ability to function, you know? And I think this is a classic example of how both of these need airtime, as it were, in relationship.
We're speaking with journalist and author Greg Lavoie about his new book, Vital Signs, The Nature and Nurture of Passion. You can be part of our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Back in 2 minutes with Greg Lavoie.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist and author Greg Lavoie about his new book, Vital Signs, The Nature and Nurture of Passion. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. This book reminded me that curiosity is really a gift.
Curiosity. Oh, it's a gift. It's a tremendous gift. In fact, I think that the greatest gift my father ever gave me was that, was curiosity. And the way that he typically, and he had a scientific mind. It wasn't what he did with his vocational life. He probably should have, but he went into business instead of science. But he used to play, his favorite game to play with me and my two brothers while we were growing up, taught us the gift of curiosity and wonder. And he called it the alien game. So the way it worked is, in brief, is, he was an alien from another planet, which we had suspected all along. But we were the guides on Earth. So we would go out into the neighborhood. This is in New York, or down by the shore into the city. And he would ask questions about the planet that he saw, and we had to try to explain it to him. All right? So what are the white formations that move through your atmosphere? Right?
Clouds.
What are they made of?
Water vapor.
How do they get up there, and what holds them up?
So, very interesting.
Yeah, so we had to try to explain and explore and try to figure this out. And you know, the whole afternoon would go by while we Earthlings tried to explain what holds it up if we know that water is heavier than air, you know? And mostly how it's possible you can know so much and really understand so little. And that goes not just for the curiosity about the outer world, but the inner world as well. And that wasn't a domain my father was interested in, but later in life I was. So to turn that curiosity piece inward to ourselves and wonder is, a tremendous skill. And it's one of those skills that contributes to being larger than life, I think.
What about gratitude? Where does gratitude fit in with something like wonder?
Gratitude. Oh, I think it fits intimately. Frankly, I think it's the other side of the coin. To have a sense of reverence about the world and appreciation that you're here at all, just the sheer almost impossibility of the fact that we're here should just amaze us on a regular basis. When I fly in airplanes, which I do all the time for work, I'm always amazed that the pilot doesn't get on the intercom and say, ladies and gentlemen, I would just like to point your attention to the fact that we are flying over a cloud.
Can you believe this is working? Right.
Right. Because that, to me, never ceases to amaze me. And so I just think gratitude is just an acknowledgement that I appreciate being here. I appreciate that I'm healthy, that I have love in my life, that I have work that I love, that the world continues to spin around, that just all the beauties and the joys and the wonders of the world. I just think a gratitude practice is such an essential part of living passionately, just a regular sense of gratitude.
What causes people, when there are so many reasons to be grateful and to feel gratitude, there are people who kind of put on this cloak of cynicism, right? And they just don't quite trust anything. And I'm sure that if you were to walk into their world and say, I just flew over a cloud, they would say, well, big deal.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Get over it. Well, I think cynicism, frankly, is having had high expectations and disappointing results. And I think that's very easy to come by, and you will never be at a lack for finding people to be cynical about things. In fact, one of my former favorite ways of sabotaging myself was to blurt out some newfound passion or enthusiasm to my most cynical family member. You really might as well just disembowel yourself on the spot. Because what's going to happen at that point is that the cynic is going to do what cynics do. They're going to find all the problems, all the obstacles. They're going to ask you those devil's advocate questions that, in my opinion, always tend to be a little heavy on the devil and a little light on the advocate.
Right.
You know, at the very least, I think you need to know that with those kinds of shares, you need to start with the easy customers and work your way up to the tough ones, not the other way around, unless, you know, your unconscious objective is to sabotage yourself. But you really, I think probably this goes for other people as well as myself, I really should have known better in terms of the response that I got. I end up feeling disappointed and betrayed and unsupported when I should have known better given that I was raised by that person. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But this is one of the ways that we can sabotage ourselves, undermine ourselves, is to find cynical people to talk to when we really need support.
So what did it take for you to learn to be comfortable with, as you say, being clueless when you're trying something new that you're excited about?
Oh, again, I thank my dad, really, because he taught me that there is no shame in not knowing something, that in fact, is the key to discovery and knowledge. Who was it? Isaac Asimov? I think it was Isaac Asimov who said the most interesting phrase in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not eureka. It's, that's funny.
Right, because there's another question.
Right, exactly. And so I continued. And of course, I've made my living asking questions and being clueless. I mean, I'm a journalist by training. And so not knowing something, there's no shame attached to that. So I'm always puzzled. I mentioned this in the book. I'm attending one of the Super Bowl parties with some friends watching football, and I don't know jack about football. And I'm asking these kind of questions that clearly are apparent to everybody but me. Like, are they allowed to grab onto each other's hair and clothing? Why is dancing in the end zone frowned on? You know, just really basic stuff. How come some fumbles are picked up and some are avoided? And a couple of people were very patiently explaining it to me. But afterwards, a friend of mine came up and said she was embarrassed for me asking such amateur questions in front of a bunch of football freaks. And I honest to God, it never entered my mind that I had any reason to feel ashamed of not knowing anything about football.
And it seems to me that when someone has a passion for something like football, typically they're delighted to share that with you.
That's what I found. That's what I found. I think it was the friend who was saying that she felt embarrassed for me, who has some difficulty being in a not knowing position.
Yeah.
You know, that for her, there is some shame attached to that. But to me, questions are the alakazam that open up all the boxes. And so asking questions is something that I do just everywhere and in every situation.
So how do you keep the questions alive in a relationship with someone that you've known maybe for decades?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I'm a big believer in having separate time as well as together time, of course. And in whatever your discoveries are out in your own separate lives, and I believe even so far as separate vacations, I believe in even time apart during vacations, to bring those discoveries back into the relationship and to share them. You know, I think you bring spark back into relationship, frankly, the same way you do in your own life when you're bored, is look for some novelty. Do novel things together, right? Yes, after a certain amount of time, and I've been married myself for 20 years, not now, but I have been. Yes, there's a certain amount of taking somebody for granted when that happens. But it requires, again, a certain amount of vigilance and diligence to be doing new things together and draw novelty into the relationship and take some separate time. I mean, I have a metaphor that I use in that chapter where my father had built a contraption in the basement of the house where I grew up. It was an electrical generator called a Tesla coil, and it had two copper wires at the top between which a spark, a purple spark, would fly back and forth. And I think of this metaphor when I think of the work of keeping passion alive in a relationship. And one of the elements is this: whether we're talking about sparks flying between two poles or two people, I think the same principle applies, which is a spark requires a gap, right? In other words, some space in the relationship. I just think this idea, these fantasies we have about oneness, the two shall be as one, I'm nothing without you. I mean, this isn't intimacy. It's enmeshment and frankly, cannibalism.
It's unsustainable is what you're saying.
I think so. Mm-hmm. And so the notion of really creating some healthy space between and acknowledging that the other person is, in fact, an other with ideas of their own and agendas of their own that may run counter to ours, I think personally is a critical piece of keeping passion alive.
The new book by journalist and author Greg Lavoie is called Vital Signs, The Nature and Nurture of Passion. Greg, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for making this time for
Thanks
us.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
We want to thank all of you who are listening today, all of you who have been here for the conversations on Think day in and day out. Thanks.